Podcast 082, Book Review of Sepulter's Permaculture, Chapter 1, Part 3.
Sponsored by my buddies at PantryParadis.com. They sell food preservation tools. Produce, prepare, preserve your own harvest. All right, so this is what, Part 4? Three?
Four. The third day, I suppose. Yeah.
The third chunk in attempting to get through Sepulter's permaculture. Who knows how many parts this is going to be. Maybe we're going to be able to do one podcast every 10 pages. This is, there is a lot of good stuff here. So Kelda, part of the reason why you're in on this with me is because you're going to be teaching a class at Bastyr, where all the naturopath doctors get trained up. And so you're evaluating this to see if this will be of use to those students. Like if it's of such great use to see if that they should be required to buy it in order to be able to take your class, right?
Well, it's a holistic business practices class, so I'm recommending some readings, and this might be one, especially because it focuses on the how do you take permaculture and make a business out of it. Sepulter has a lot of good ideas. Other recommended readings I'm doing are Joel Salatin's Everything I Want to Do is Illegal, that one, and then... someone recommended that I read The Companies We Keep, which is a book recently put out by Chelsea Green, in which it goes through this all these different business models. I guess it's a very, very inspiring book. And then a pamphlet about grants, how to write grants, things like that. So that's kind of my idea for, you know, what the textbooks could be as far as permaculture, okay. Making money for people in a business model.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, we definitely know. So I guess the reason why I'm asking this is that as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, and I've already browsed it like a dozen times, but as I'm reading this, you know, sentence by sentence, word for word, I'm just thinking this is really awesome. But then I'm kind of thinking, like, one of the things that I frequently do is to say to people something like, if you're going to go out, and you're going, like, you have never done a garden before, I recommend getting Mel Bartholomew's
square
book,
foot. Yeah.
Square Foot Gardening.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, now once you've got a little bit of gardening under your belt, then the next book I recommend is to get Toby Hemingway's Gaia's Garden. Now I'm reading this, and I don't think it displaces Toby from the number one slot.
Right. It could be a next level or something.
I'm not sure if it's the next level, but it's like, you know, I'm beginning to wonder if I might say, you know, you could also get Sepp Holzer's book.
Right. I also like to throw in Heather Flora's Food Not Lawns. Pretty, like, I would recommend that along with Gaia's Garden, especially because Heather throws in more social dynamics than, I mean, Toby touches on it, but, you know, the subtitle of her book is How to Turn Your Yard into a Garden and Your Neighborhood into a Community. And so I think it's an overall reaching one, and it's very simple as far as the food growing goes, and it's very simple as far as its approach to community building, and so that's the one I would put in, maybe before Sepulter even, because, and then that's that catchy title and the diagrams, Food Not Lawns, is a really excellent one too.
See, I kind of feel like when I've heard this thing, Food Not Lawns, in fact, I used to have a
have
housemate
you read
that was
the book?
I have not even read the book.
Aha,
I've never read the
right.
book. No, and so I'm going entirely off of the title.
Uh-huh.
And so I remember I used to have a housemate who was involved in the Food Not Lawns stuff. And she was thinking that they were trying to change their name so they didn't have a negative in it. The not.
Right.
Sure. You know, and then when it comes to lawns, I basically feel like lawns have a function in our world that is really quite good. So I like the idea of displacing. I mean, I do see a lot of land where it's like you've got 2 acres of lawn and you don't even have kids or grandkids and you don't do anything with it all year long except mow it. You don't even go and set a table out there and have lunch one day a year.
Right.
It's just, it's the whole one great big vast gob of how do we put chemicals into the earth, but through 2 acres of lawn. So,
Yes, and I know where your rant is going is insane. Like, yes, decrease the lawn, but in general, we also have uses for lawns. I think I've heard this rant from you before.
More than once. Good.
And so, yeah, it's like in our yard, we definitely have parties. I dry seeds. I have all sorts of uses for the lawn, you know, where to hang your laundry, stuff like that. So, but the Food Not Lawns book I'd still recommend, even if the name seems like it would be strange for you.
It would seem like it would say, don't have any lawn. All lawns are bad, which I hear from a lot of permaculture people. All lawns are bad. And I just want to, you know. So anyway, the book, does it say all lawns are bad?
I don't think she does.
Okay.
It's more of like a spin-off the Food Not Bombs movement.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Right.
Make love, not war.
Yeah.
So, okay. All right. So Seth Poulter's book.
Okay.
We're on page 21 here.
Yes.
Microclimates.
Yeah.
And the first blurb I've marked off is, this is why I try to create as many microclimates as possible throughout a permaculture system. The diversity of plants and animals helps to create a system in which every species will find its natural balance. This is the only way to prevent the population of any one species from becoming dominant and reducing the overall integrity of the ecosystem. So I kind of feel like this is the calling card for EDGE.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think EDGE is something where it's like over a podcast, it's kind of hard to describe what is EDGE. And I've tried several times in the podcast. You have... I don't know. You're a permaculture instructor. How would you describe EDGE?
Well, the meeting of two different systems, whether it's water and land or different types of plant communities. And, my biggest thought from this section about microclimates, I think Sepp Holter really does so well with microclimates. He's really strong on that. And I like how he's got so much land and he focuses on microclimates too. So he's looking for the edges, the little tiny edges throughout this big swath of property. And I think when people have a lot of land, they tend not to think about the little parts of it and as much, you know, really figuring out what is going on right behind that rock or right behind, you know, this tree. And I think that's why Sepp Holter has so much success, is he doesn't think in broad swaths as much as the little microclimates.
Well, he even tries to create edge inside of the pond and microclimates,
yeah,
inside of the pond. And so in one of his videos, he talks about, okay, whenever I make a pond, I got to throw a bunch of stumps and logs and stuff in there. So that way, all the little fish have a place to hide from the big fish. Otherwise, the little fish are always stressed out and typically all gobbled up. And so they need to have their hiding places. But basically, it's like those logs and stumps and whatnot that are in there are acting as more edge, and then he shapes his ponds with more edge, and then I like the way that you were describing it. Like, even if he has a big tract of land, a huge, like if you have 100 acres and it's just one great big flat expanse and you have nothing but wheat growing on it, then that seems to be a pitiful piece of land. But you know, if Sepp comes along, then he's going to plant bunches of trees here, and he's going to allow some flat spaces over there and some sun traps and some ponds, and now he's introducing all this texture to the land. And it's all that texture that makes, like, an, you know, it increases the edge on the property by a factor of 100,000.
Right.
And so now all kinds of different things can grow there that couldn't grow there before. And the stuff that even wheat can grow there better than it could when it was one great big flat expanse. So I think so I really like the way that you were saying that about, even though it's a big tract of land, and what makes land rich is going to be a lot of texture to the land, which is effectively microclimates, micro edges, and the more texture and the finer grain. It's like if we go back to the analogy of an artist and a painting, then the richer and more detailed the painting is.
Yeah, and I also like to throw in something that I've heard from Marisha Auerbach, is that permaculture is about making homes. So making homes for plants, making homes for wildlife, but about that idea that within the landscape, everybody's got their unique home and figuring out how to make that happen for them.
That's true. That's a good way of looking at it, too. That's a good way of looking at it. I like that. I like that. All right, the next blurb I've got marked off.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bigger blurb. So I hope that Chelsea Green doesn't come and slap me upside the head for quoting too big of a blurb. But it's not even a full paragraph. On my travels in South Africa, northern Brazil, and Colombia, I have seen large stretches of land lying fallow. Fallow means it's just sitting there and ain't doing nothing. It's like got no plants on it whatsoever. The land is completely unprotected against erosion and is gradually drying out. It is in exactly these countries that we need to use microclimates to change unproductive areas back into fertile land. On this kind of land, I could, for instance, plant particularly hardy and fast-growing trees to create a kind of pioneer forest to protect the land from erosion and prevent it from drying out. Later on, more demanding fruit trees can grow safely amongst the initial ones. Once they are stable and have grown large enough, the pioneer trees will no longer be required and can be cut down and used for timber. Another way to establish cultures is by making raised beds on top of large branches and shrubs. Then I can introduce seeds like mango or papaya into the bed. All right. The thing that is the most important part to me from this is that we ain't in the cold zone anymore, Dorothy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Am I saying that right? Toto. No, I'm supposed to say Toto. Well, anyway, the thing is that he travels so much and he goes to these incredibly hot regions, which are so different from the Kramerhof, and yet he has massive success. And I think it comes back. Oh, anyway, so basically, he's not just the things that he advocates are not just for like, okay, you know, is your climate the same as Sepp's? Whereas with Salatin's stuff, so much of Salatin's advice is like not going to work really well beyond outside of a climate that's not Salatin's climate. In fact, my Uncle Doug went out there and visited Salatin's place, and that was his analysis of like, well, Salatin's going to have great luck because he's got this topsoil that's 6 feet deep. So it's going to work great for him, but it's not all of it's going to work great for other people. But in that summer that I read the 100 gardening books, that was one thing I started to kind of figure out, is a lot of those books are only going to work. Like the advice that they're giving is only going to work for a particular climate. And so many books are that way. And that doesn't mean that a lot of, like, you know, Salatin stuff is still rather ingenious and awesome and fantastic and what an amazing leap. But, like, you know, some of it you got to kind of, like, weigh out with your own personal climate. Sepp has the experience from all of them. And he writes, you know, the things that he advises and suggests take into account all these different possible climates, which is, I think a lot of permaculture books are that way. The Big Black Book, the Designer's Manual, I mean, it has full chapters dedicated to different kinds of climates. So I think that, I don't know, this is one of the things that's just kind of like, man, this guy is awesome.
Well, and I think part of it is that focusing on microclimates, you can do that in any climate. And so it's kind of the technique is easily transferable. And I'd say Salatin also does – it's the difference between, like, teaching the straight-up technique and then the thinking behind the technique. And I think Salatin also gets into the thinking that led him to design his paddock system. So that kind of thinking can be applied somewhere else, even if it doesn't look exactly the same, even if the rotations aren't exactly the same kind of days. But, yeah, I like how Sepp talks about how these microclimates, you can focus on, it's worthy to focus on them in any climate you're at around the world.
Yeah, and then he gives examples. Whereas I kind of feel like with Fukuoka, we talk about how Fukuoka and Seb's techniques are very similar, even though Fukuoka is in a much warmer area than Seb. Fukuoka's writing is all really quite meta and kind of light on examples. And a lot of, yeah. And I understand that Fukuoka traveled around a lot and gave a lot of advice to a lot of different places too. But Fukuoka's stuff was very much more of a philosophy of observe and, you know, observe and do. Well, same thing that Sepp is advocating, only Sepp's willing to go out on a limb and make all kinds of very specific recommendations, but he qualifies all of his specific stuff with, like, and here's where this works. And mm-hmm. but it won't work so good over there. And in fact, there's a bunch of stuff in this section where he's saying exactly that for a variety of things, and there's just too much of it to convey, I think, in this podcast.
Right. Basically, he's talking about how water moves on the land and how to design the soils differently if you're in low rain areas versus high rain areas, what your soil type is like. It'd actually be handy maybe even to make a chart, you know, like it's some things I can read and understand and some things I have to, like, look at in a chart and really see how they work together.
Well, he's got gobs of charts in here, doesn't he?
That last part about if you have this kind of soil, then build the bed this way. If you have this kind of rain, and then, that's what I would do if I was, like, stepping up this homework. Hmm?
Maybe what we need is a book that's like a make-your-own-adventure book. If your soil is like this, turn to page 22.
Right.
If your soil is like this, turn to page 47.
Something
like that. And then finally you'll get to the recipes that are for your stuff or whatever. I don't know.
Right. By the way, can you hear the cat in the background? Is that...
No. You're going to have to bring the cat closer.
No. He's kind of bothering me, but if you can't hear it, that's cool. It's fine.
I used to have a cat named Walter Cronkite, and he'd come in to the house, and then he'd go meow, meow, meow. I mean, just stand there and look at everybody and do that for 3 minutes, and then he was done. And then he'd go somewhere else. And he did that every night at about 6 o'clock. So it was weird. I gave him the name Walter Cronkite when he was a kitten and I first got him, and I didn't know anything about him. But it turned out to be so fitting. You know, he comes in, he tells everybody the news, and then you don't see him until the next day. What an awesome cat. He loved to eat birds. Mm. And he loved to take them apart under my son's bed. So under my son's bed is this zillions of feathers and bones. And we're constantly cleaning it out under there. So anyway, as long as we're talking about cats, I just thought I'd share. Cats that talk. Cats that have something to say.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, one of my next notes is that he does talk about just throwing branches under the terraces, which is interesting because in the last podcast I expressed all this concern about just throwing branches instead of rotting wood when people are making small hugel cultures. And he says he does it and that it's it'll take a while to get started up, but once it starts raining, then the branches will soak up the water. So there you go. I did like how you mentioned to heavily mulch those areas too. So that's something I can recommend if I see people doing raised beds with branches underneath, is to try to work that mulch too, just so the moisture stays in there for longer, because the branches are taking a percentage of that when the bed is getting established.
So I think I marked off a blurb that mentioned that, because I was thinking the exact same thing the last time you were talking about, you know, burying branches and stuff. But okay, I'm going to go ahead and read my next blurb, and I'm going to keep going until I find the part where it talks about the branches, because I'm sure I circled that. In the Scottish Highlands, the situation was completely different. The areas that I visited had been cleared centuries ago. Now, there is nothing but miles and miles of heath with not a tree to be seen. The rainfall there is very heavy, and the wind is quite strong and never stops. This makes it difficult for anything other than heather and sedge to grow. The pH value of the soil has sunk to a value between 4 and 5, so any yield from such an area would be minimal. In places like these, it is vital to set up sun traps and windbreaks. So, yet another odd climate, another climate that's nothing like any of the ones we've mentioned before. And I know that in his presentations, he talks about some of the work he's done in the Scottish Islands before. And I think it was really impressive. I mean, that was a place where he took that grain of his, and the grain just super outdid itself, growing 8.5 feet tall, which I think is pretty spectacular for grain. So that was one place where it would really sing. As the system develops, the land will begin to resemble a rag rug. Many irregularly shaped landforms will be created, which will produce numerous microclimates. In this way, the diversity of plants will continue to increase. What? You thought a rag rug makes you laugh?
Well, yeah, we don't have enough rag rugs over here in the United States to, I mean, we know what it is, we get, you know, but I don't remember seeing one of those for a long time. But yeah, I get the point. It's very, but lumpy texture.
Lumpy texture. I mean, texture. That's kind of what we were just talking about. I think the rag rug analogy is really, really good in that, you know, we take something that's kind of flattish and we can introduce a texture to it that is not necessarily as conducive to a tractor, but it is very conducive to diversity and microclimates. So, all right. Moving along, he has this section. Okay, so then he starts talking about terraces and paths, and basically a path is a terrace is a path. And then you know what's weird is that you and I were driving from Missoula to Bonner's Ferry, and along the highway – I remember I stopped the car and took pictures, but there was somebody there who had just terraced their land intensively, just like the picture in this book.
Huh.
And it looked like they'd made a crater garden. And it was, in fact, this, you know, the picture in this book, it's like as if it was that same picture I took from the side of that road. And I don't know, it's just... made me think of that little nutty.
Yeah, well, it's funny. It's like, where was I? I was there.
I think you'd been up late the night before. You might have like, look. Right. I know I made you wake up to look at it. Look at that. And then you were kind of like, right. Fuck, Paul, leave me alone.
Right. Okay. Anyway.
Can't you tell I'm trying to sleep here? So I took pictures, and you must have slept. But the thing is that these are a bunch of terraces that are each like about 4 to 8 feet wide, so much narrower than I would typically do for a terrace. I've done terracing on my farm in Mount Spokane. I did a bunch of terraces. I was shooting for trying to get all my terraces to be at least 100 feet wide because I wanted to move equipment in there for harvesting and stuff. Mm. But much like what Sepp talks about. But then, okay, so then he goes into building a terrace system.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of got confused. I'm trying to figure out what he's talking about. And so he's got gradient and risers. Did you understand what he meant by these?
A bit. I read it through twice, to be honest. And I was like, okay, if I was doing this for real, I'd probably kind of get it as I played with the soil, and that's how I sometimes I do modeling before I do terraces, because it helps me understand what's gonna happen, you know, with a smaller piece of soil or something. So somewhat, I mean, the picture, where's that picture on 27 helped, because you see the riser down there. Right.
It says riser.
The confusing part is it says on the embankment, the same material is used to form the embankment. What same material? As the riser?
Riser.
As what?
The riser is the foundation of the embankment.
Right.
And is angled slightly into the hill. What does that mean? So I always kind of think that you've got the terraces and then you've got like the slopey bit between the terraces. So maybe embankment and riser means the slopey bit between the terraces. But then it's like the other phrases that they use to describe it and to talk about the amount of slope, it doesn't make sense. But the big thing is that the slopey bit between the terraces is going to be much steeper than the original slope, because, you know, and instead of having a gradual slope, you've got some steep slope stuff, and you got some flat stuff, which
right.
is the terrace itself.
And that's where the riser comes in, because it bumps that out so that that part is steeper for a bit. You see how maybe it, when he means angled back into the hill, it's not flat on top. It actually goes down. It's like a mini hill. And the poor people listening to the podcast can't look at this picture.
We've got to be making it worse.
Yeah.
But it's like, even if you go out and you buy the book and you look at the pictures, it's kind of like, it's, you know, it's still not exactly clear. Okay, one thing that's important that Sepp does make a point about, and that is, and I think I've got it as a blurb I've circled here later, is that it's really important that the terrace itself have a very slight downslope. It's important. He says it, how it's important that the slope not go into the hill. And I would have to say that if you're new to this terracing thing, yes, absolutely. The slope should always, always, always go, have a downhill slope to it. Even the flat part should have a downhill slope to it, just ever so slight.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that if you've got any clay in there, then what happens is you've made this terrace, like let's say it slopes into the hill. And so then the water ends up kind of accumulating as it rains. It kind of accumulates next to the hillside, so it's kind of on the terrace but next to the hillside. Well, what happens is that then your whole terrace becomes this great big waterlogged gob of jello, and it becomes so intensively jelloified, full of water, like so soupy full of water, that it decides that rather than hanging out on your property, it's going to go downhill and visit the neighbors.
Right.
Probably something you'd rather didn't happen. And so, therefore, just to be safe, have a little bit of a slope that takes it so you don't have any... So basically what you're trying to do is trying to create a recipe so you don't have any mud puddles on your terrace. However... I'm going to hereby talk about a slightly different strategy for very advanced terrace makers, and that's going to be if your soil is really gravelly and it's really got super duper drainage, I would make it slope slightly in, or I would cup it a bit with the idea that the water's going to run through and it's not going to make it all full of water and spongy, because you're having a hard time getting the water to stick. You're having a hard time getting the soil to stick. You're having a hard time getting anything to stick. So I'll try to slow it down and accumulate, you know, whatever little bits of silt I can. And so I would do that. Now, another thing is, I know that for the terraces that I made, out on Mount Spokane, I would make a terrace, and then I would kind of put a swale on the end lip of the terrace. However, Sepp wouldn't do that, because what Sepp does is when he makes his terraces, he doesn't – because what I did on Mount Spokane, which turned out to be not Sepp's way, which was probably the wrong way, what I did was I made them follow contour lines. I made them totally, absolutely level.
Uh-huh.
And Sepp makes all of his terraces have a little bit of a wave to them, kind of like at the Bullock Brothers. The terraces at the Bullock Brothers have a little bit of a wave to them. They're not on contour. They kind of go up and down and up and down very, very slightly, just a little bit. And the reason why he does that, and maybe he'll explain it more later in the book, is that you're going to have a higher points on the wave, and it's like maybe you're going to have like a wave peak every couple of hundred feet, and the wave is only going to be like a foot or two. So then that means that you're going to have higher points on your terrace and lower points on your terrace, and you've introduced even more microclimate. So the higher points of the terrace are going to be drier, and the lower points are going to be wetter. And so you'll be able – you've made lots more microclimate right there.
Right. And I think this is a difficult one to pass on to someone, because the thing about terraces and swales is that you want to hold water. You want to hold more water in your landscape, but you don't want to hold too much. And it'd be interesting to see if someone had worked out what's a good equation for that. But I think a lot of people just learn by trial and error what is the right kind of slope for their terraces, whether it should be flat on contour or it should be slightly downhill, depending on what their conditions are like. And then it probably also changes once the plants start to grow considerably. Like once trees are really well established, they could probably soak up a lot more water. But at first, you don't want that thing to blow out, and so you would angle it slightly downhill. So a lot of it is just I don't quite get it, and it's probably because it's such a local thing. You just have to experiment and see what works.
Well, and the answer is going to be it depends.
Right. Yeah.
It depends on so many different factors. I mean, in this part, he even talks about, like, you know, what you're going to try to do when you're in a very dry climate is going to be very different from when you're in a really wet climate.
Yeah.
And I think that this is one of those cases where if you're in a really wet climate, then I think I would still have some slope away with the idea that the texture of your terrace is still going to hold in the silt, and the water is going to move so slowly off, it'll be just the water moving off instead of the water and the soil moving off.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got a really dry climate, then you're probably going to want to, like, not let that water just run down. You're probably going to do all kinds of things to try and retain that water. So your terraces are also going to be part of a system of water collection to try and go to ponds and the like to try and hold that water just as long as you possibly can.
Right, but I think he talks also in dry climates you want to angle it down so that, you know, he didn't say flash floods, but that was the – that was what I caught from it, is you also want to be able to handle huge volumes of water when the earth is so dry it can't soak things up.
True, there is that. But, on the top of things, if the land is so dry that it can't soak things up, you probably have a clay soil. Mm-hmm. In which case, if you've got a clay soil, definitely slope it away. Because clay takes water in very slowly. And on top of that, with a clay soil, if you have a mud puddle sitting on top of a big gob of clay, that it's going to turn into one great big sack of jello that tries to go downhill to visit the neighbors.
Right.
So
anyway.
Mud puddles on top of a big gob of clay, not a good recipe.
Right. So anyway, all you right. Can see where a chart would come in handy.
Yes. Buy the damn book already. Okay. Next blurb, mistakes are frequently made when the operator of the mechanical digger or the person in charge does not have enough experience and fails to preserve the topsoil. Mm-hmm. So with pond projects, I was overlooking at a pond project about 2 days ago, and the person that was in charge was explaining to me how they're digging all this really big black muck out of the middle of this wet spot, which used to be a pond but was kind of filling in, and they're going to use this black muck to build the dam. And then I was saying, boy, you really don't want to do that.
Mm-mm.
You want to take all the black muck, set it aside, and then you keep getting down, and then you're going to find, like, all the subsoil that's going to be like a lot of clay and gravel and sand and stuff like that. And that clay and sand stuff, that's what you build your dam out of. And when the dam's all built, then you put the mucky stuff on top of that. And that mucky stuff's going to make amazing, rich soil. But the mucky stuff makes the worst possible dams. And so I think the same thing goes for when building a terrace, although one could argue that if you end up with the topsoil down deeper, then you've kind of made another kind of edge. You'll have pockets where when something gets a taproot going, they're going to go down and they're going to hit this patch of organic matter. On the other hand, as that organic matter breaks down over the years, you might end up with sinkholes. probably, which could be a bad thing or it could be a good thing. It would create a whole new kind of edge out in the middle of your terrace.
Yeah.
So, but typically, usually, the smart thing to do is to take all the topsoil and set it aside, shape everything, and then put the topsoil back. And so then that way you have lots of luscious topsoil on the top where it's going to do you the most good. All right, next blurb. You should under no circumstances angle any watercourses or ditches into the hill because the highest terrace can become waterlogged, and this greatly increases the danger of landslides. So I think that was the thing that I was just saying a moment ago, but, you know, his way sounds clearer than
right.
I was. It's going to go visit the neighbors. All right. So then it goes on to so you got working with water, stabilizing the system, and that's where you're planting a lot of different things into it. Managing a terrace culture. So under managing a terrace culture, I've got two big blurbs here that I want to go over. On poor soils or on steep slopes, deep-rooted green manure crops like sweet clover and lupins are best. They stabilize the terrace with their deep root systems. They also improve the nutrient content of poor soils with their ability to fix nitrogen and make it available to other plants, which is assisted by symbiotic bacteria. In wetter areas, alsike clover can be sown and white clover and black medic can be used for plant cover. Other plants that are suitable for plant cover can be found in the green manure section. Oh, good. We got a green manure section coming up. I've been collecting a whole bunch of video footage to put together a video on sweet clover. Ooh. And because it is such an amazing plant for getting things started, yet so many people look at it and think it's a weed.
Mm-hmm.
I think sweet clover might even be considered a noxious weed in some states. So here we've got Sep saying, don't forget your noxious weeds. Those are some of your best friends.
Oh, yeah, because he uses comfrey, you know, he goes for it.
Well, yeah, a lot of permaculture plants are on noxious weed lists somewhere because they're just so effective at going and correcting a monocrop situation. And most of the stuff that's on a noxious weed list is there because the people that are doing the monocrops are annoyed by nature trying to heal that patch of land with these plants. And so they find it annoying. I could rant on that one for an hour, but I'm going to let
right.
it go for
right, right, right.
Yeah,
well, and what I've been thinking from a lot of this, too, is that it's a great, you know, especially when he was talking about Scotland, how this area has been cleared. It's been used so intensively for thousands of years. It's really lacking a lot of biomass, and it's very acidic, that these finding these microclimates and doing the kinds of earthworks that he talks about is maybe the first step in doing restoration, of course, and it gets all this food coming back, but then also gives the earth there the ability to regrow what was growing there before the clearing began, or in a slightly modified way. Around here, I just think of all the pictures we have of turn of the century, where it's just totally deforested. There's a few like sticks in the background, you know, black and white pictures of people looking kind of sad and miserable and a really pathetic forest in the background. And I think that is it's a cool way of using Sep Pulser's stuff to, like, you know, go in, find these little microclimates, add to these microclimates, whether it's terraces, swales, and then really boosting fertility back into the area. So,
and he's got, there, a lot of the stuff that I skipped over was stuff where he's like, okay, I'm approaching this big flat expanse of land. And so here's what I'm going to do to heal it. here's what I'm going to do to add texture back to this land. And he kind of has a recipe for it. He kind of lays it out. I think he was, like, talking about something in South Africa or something like that. But it's like the recipe is like the standard recipe that almost all permaculture people do. It's what Jeff Lawton does in his Food Forest DVD. It's what all these people, all of permaculture, the Big Black Book describes doing this exact same thing.
Right.
And it's like, okay, here we got this big gob of monoculture that they hate because the soil's now shitty and, you know, they just are struggling with weeds all the time and it's driving them nuts. So let's go in there and let's sepify the land. And it's like first go in there with a bunch of stuff that are considered invasive trees and invasive weeds and all these legumes and just plant the hell out of it with all this diversity and texture on the land. And, well, wait a minute. All right, so now I'm paraphrasing. I'm going to, like... make the whole book talking about it. But it's like really, really good information and, you know, a recipe from point A to point B on how to make that land productive and more aligned with nature.
Mm-hmm. Totally. It also made me think of, have you read Brad Lancaster's story about Mr. Fury in Zimbabwe?
No. Well, okay. I've heard about Mr. Fury. Isn't he the guy that's like, he's like right on the edge of the Sahara, and it's like where he's at is just getting, like basically he's reversing desertification. But, of course, the government came out and tried to stop him from doing what he's doing because it must be bad because Monsanto didn't say it was okay.
Well, yeah, I don't know that part exactly, but yeah, the government had done some really backward things before he started, just, you know, basically starting by rearranging rocks. Just so that they caught more water and created more microclimate.
Right, right. Apparently there's like a video that's like an hour-long video out about him, and Jack Spirico got it and saw it and thought it was awesome, and he kept emailing me like as he would watch every, you know, 20 minutes of the video. And it was like, this is so awesome. So he said he was going to send me the DVD, but I imagine what he did instead was is that he watched it like 8 more times and forgot all about me. Because right. I never saw it. It never arrived. but I saw like the trailer for it or something, and it does look very, very cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Next blurb. Using this method, I have managed over the course of time to cultivate the most demanding types of vegetable on what was once the acid soil of a former spruce culture. By autumn, the plant cover will have begun to decompose and will protect the soil from frost. The earth will not freeze as quickly, which means that the invertebrates and microorganisms in the upper layers of the soil will survive longer in the spring and autumn. The practice of cutting grasses back in the summer and autumn and removing them to make hay is a terrible mistake. All right, so there's a couple of things in here. Mostly when I started reading that, I thought he was going to start talking about the worms and stuff that he has to mend acidified soil.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently there are like 3 or 4 different things that he does, because he does not bring lime onto his land.
Oh.
And so when he's got a problem with acidic soil, he does all of these other techniques. So, for example, if you were to have a lot of comfrey and dandelion growing, those are both calcium accumulators. So they would shoot these big old taproots way down deep. They bring up calcium. They actually, both of them, actually exude a little bit of it right out their leaves as they're transpiring. Not a lot, but a little bit. But the key is that the plant itself, when it dies, and which isn't very often because they're both perennials, but it'll exude lots of calcium, and that they're for that one thing would indeed help to raise the pH of soil. But apparently there's also an earthworm that he breeds that tends to have a different pattern of living its life than most other earthworms, whereas most earthworms tend to stay within the top 8 inches of soil during, you know, the warmer season, and then they kind of hibernate, but not exactly hibernate. They sort of hibernate at about 3 feet deep, These soil, or these worms, these earthworms make it a habit of like going 6 to 8 feet down and then coming back up all the time, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, thus bringing a bunch of the calcium type stuff that would be further down. Because earthworms, they don't really like the acidic soils. They far prefer the soils closer to neutral. And so then, you know, they'll go down and they'll find calcium, and then they'll bring it back up and poop it on the surface. So that would be another way of improving the pH of your soil without using lime. So I was kind of hoping, as I was reading this, like, oh, he's going to talk about it. He's going to describe his techniques. And he didn't. Damn it. But he does go on, and he talks about the whole idea of, like, of hay, which is true for almost any crop. You go and you, but hay is like such a massive producer. It pumps all this organic matter up above the soil line, and then you come and you cut it down and you haul it away. And then so basically you drain the soil of organic matter. And that soil becomes poorer and poorer.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point he's trying to make. Like making hay is one of the worst things you could possibly do. Which, by the way, he doesn't make hay, but I heard his son, and it's kind of like, you know, Sepp's got his messages that he conveys, but his son Yosef kind of sometimes rolls his eyes and tells you the inside story.
Yeah.
and so then from Yosef I find out all these other little things. Like when I ask Sepp about how many days, does he set aside any feed to feed the chickens? And Sepp will say, I have to read from the Book of Nature. And Yosef will say, oh, they do go out and they harvest a little bit. And then, you know, they do the same thing other people do, where it's like, you know, they have lots of chickens throughout the growing season, and then they harvest a bunch of them in the fall, and then they have just a few to get through the winter. And then they'll set aside a little bit of food, and they'll feed the chickens about 12 days over the winter when it's so cold out that the ground's so frozen that the chickens will have a really hard time getting their own feed.
Yeah. And I think he's talked about Sepulcher has classes where people come and they sleep in a barn on hay bales. So that's coming from somewhere. I'm pretty sure he would not be buying it. But, you know, he does harvest grains. And so maybe there's a more sustainable way that he harvests hay for you know, just to get livestock through the winter and supplemental anyway.
I know the answer to this.
Oh?
No, I know. Because I asked. I mean,
Yeah.
I totally grilled Yosef. So on pigs, they don't set anything aside for pigs at all. Pigs can self-harvest all year long, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But the cattle struggle. They need about 2 months of feed. So, I mean, they're at Holter's place, they're very big on the animals self-harvesting all year long.
Right, but then they're covered in all the snow for maybe, you know, I'd say more than 2 months, I would guess.
So Sepp said that what they do is that the guy next door, he bales hay, and so Sepp trades. He'll like trade food for hay. So Sepp does not make hay.
I know, but I mean, the whole argument is like hay making is the worst thing ever to deplete your soil. It's okay if your neighbor does it. I mean, it'd be nice. The nicer thing would be to set up what's a sustainable model for creating hay for your livestock for those 2 months during the wintertime. Like, what's, you know, if he put his brain on that for another couple of years, I'm sure he could think of some cool stuff.
Well, and you know, I think Joel Salatin is doing a lot in that space, there are other. I mean, there's other schools of thought, and there are people. I need to get my subscription going to the Stockman Grass Farmer Journal again. But last I read, there were some people where they were doing some things where they were able to keep their cattle going on grasses all year long in places like Montana, and not have to harvest any hay. And so I do think that there's, you know, something worth thinking about there, and or at least worth exploring. But I think that the key is, and that what Salatin does is that you go and you get your hay from different places every year.
Right,
so when I look out my window, yeah, right, I'm looking at a field of alfalfa, which is usually infested by deer, but there's only about six out there right now. But my window gazes out at this field of alfalfa. And this guy comes in twice a year and bales the hay and hauls it away. And as opposed to what Salatin does, which is that he will graze it a bunch of the year. Then he'll go in and he'll leave it alone for like, you know, 3 weeks, and it'll grow a bunch of hay, and then he'll harvest that hay, take that and set it aside, and then he'll continue to do the paddock shift grazing stuff. So it's like the amount of – and then he won't get any hay off of it the next year, maybe even the year after that. So then really it's like only one third of that year's crop is taken off for hay. And then it's got like – it's like zero is taken off for hay the next year or two. So it's hayed far less often. So there are ways.
Right. And that's kind of like a paddock system that we do, go out and do the harvesting in the paddock rather than the animals doing it themselves. But it's rotational. And it's like if you have enough land or enough different microclimates that produce hay, then yeah, you could just come by once every 10 years and take a bit, you know?
Well, you know, and we talk about, I mean, of course, Salatin is definitely making the whole paddock shift system really, really sing for him. Because when he takes hay off of the land, he's not just bringing in cattle, but he's also doing chickens and pigs on that same land and pulsing them through. And then, of course, there's the old recipe that for land like that if you do the paddock shift system, you get five times more growies on your land. So, but I don't think you can count hay as part of the pulse because the way it's cut is not the same as when it's grazed, and you don't have animals putting stuff back on the land
True.
As they're grazing it. I mean, I think that this is, making hay is a very unnatural thing, whereas the whole mob grazing that has been going on for thousands and thousands of years, featuring great big gobs of, for example, bison that are mobbed up because of predators, then I think that technique is something that has been going on. I mean, the grasses and forbs have evolved to be optimized by this thing happening, and taking that away leads to desertification, whereas putting that system in leads to all this lush growth. But the making of hay, while some ignorant boobs might look at it and say it's the same as pulsing, it's really, really not. It's an artificial harvest, and it's nothing like the natural thing that animals will do to that same plot of land.
Yes, I would agree with that. Yes.
Yes, such an important thing. All right. Hey, and that's as far as I read for this segment. And we've got plenty for a podcast. I think we need to call this good for this one.
Well, I have just one more thing to throw in, which is that he talks about the usability of the terraces and not having dead ends. And it reminds me of, I think, how keyhole gardens sometimes get unfunctional when people do too many dead ends. You know, have you ever been in a keyhole garden where it's like you naturally want to walk across, but it's not – you have to walk all the way around, you know, which is like – Yes, that's kind of like a meditation garden too, but I really, you know, there's, I definitely recommend having stepping stones or different ways to get through those dead ends for the functional part of it. And there's one garden that I was designing where we were laying out the mulch and we were all, you know, with our barrows and like as we were talking to the client, just kept walking this one path that I actually hadn't made a path. And so we decided just to make that a path and not a keyhole bed. So I think that's the balance with the keyhole beds when people get into too many dead ends, perhaps.
Spiral gardens. So I've
oh, right.
I think that there's a big difference, too, between something that's like, this is going to be a production system, this is something that we're going to be getting in and out. We need to be working with, and it's you know, a production thing. Spiral stuff just sucks. I mean, I've seen, I don't know how many gardens I've seen now where it's one great big spiral, and it's kind of like, okay, now you want to go harvest the stuff in the middle, and now you've made it a big job.
Yeah.
To go
yeah.
all the way to the middle. And right. And it's kind of like, but on the other hand, I've also seen, speaking of spiral, Albert Postuma's thing. How cool is that? I mean, a spiral with, I mean, he went in there with
well,
a track
huge.
And
I
made
mean,
that's
it. Massive, yeah.
And the idea is on this little piece of land, you can go for a really long walk. But right. he's not designing it to be something where it's a production piece of land where you're going to go in and go all the way to the middle and then harvest and bring it all the way back. You know, it's more for what being what's cool and entertainment than about production.
Right.
And in fact, somewhere I've browsed this book so many times, I know that later on in the book, Sepp Holzer lays out something where it's like, here it is on page 43, something where it's like a system where you can go for this great big long walk. He calls it a pick your own, and it's and it is kind of designed to be longer and less efficient. Because it's kind of like that's kind of like the thing. You're going to come, people are going to come and spend the day at the farm, and they're going to go and walk the full length of the path, and it just seems a lot longer than it really is because there are no shortcuts allowed. I just think that it's rather brilliant. But for a production system, yeah, I see people do the keyhole thing or whatever, and they just go too far, and it's wonky. And yeah, the whole idea of eliminating dead ends, I think, is rather brilliant in a lot of ways. Because then it's like, if it's going to take two passes to fill your bag with whatever it is you're harvesting today, and then you walk down to the end, and you're half full, but you got to walk all the way back and then go down the next row, that does seem really inefficient. And of course, you know, walking is easier to get around or anything, but it's like, well, what if the idea is that you've got a wheelbarrow and it's not going to be able to be jostled around or anything, and you're filling it up as you go along, then you get a full wheelbarrow load going up one and then back down on the other. So
yep.
Did I say stuff that supports what you said, or am I like going off on a wild ass?
Oh, yeah, Glenn, you agreed. Yeah, spiral gardens are a great example of, like, just you want to think about how you're going to use it, how you're going to maintain it, and what's going to be the most relaxing for you in the long run. So, yeah.
All right. Anything else?
Nope. I think I'm good.
Well, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about guys in Austria who travel, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.